tell you, honestly, I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Warm Down. Today, I'm joined by Rennie Mullenstein, former Manchester United first team coach, and boy, we got an absolute treat for you guys in store today. We're going to talk about all sorts, from Ronaldo, we're going to talk about Fergie, we're going to talk about his playing career, how he got into coaching. Rennie, thank you for joining us.
No problem.
Are you well?
Yeah, very well. Yeah, very well.
Right, we've already basically just done a podcast sitting on the other side of the room, but we'll get stuck into this. So let's talk about your playing career. You started coaching professionally before you finished playing, didn't you?
Not necessarily professionally. I did start my coaching as young as 16. I was obviously still playing, but in my local club where I grew up and where I played my youth football, you know, they're always looking for young coaches, and I had an interest in it. So I thought I'll give it a go. When I was 16, I was working with 8, 9, 10 years players of 10 years of age.
And that was through the Coerver. It was the Coerver method that first got you in.
No, not necessarily, because when I started coaching, obviously you try to do the things that you've learned obviously from your own coaches, but you start to develop an interest. And you know, obviously at that time I also started quite early to do my sort of youth coaching, you know, certificates and everything. And in that time, Will Kerr was very big in developing his method at the time. And I can remember walking through a nearby village, and in a bookstore there was a book, and it says the complete plan for the ideal footballer, written by Will Kerr. So I walked in, had a look at the book, looked at the outside of the book and the back, and I saw some pictures of, you know, big players at that time, and started to read the preface, and that really caught me, that preface, because when I saw it, I thought, it's so simple, basically, what he says, and so true. So I thought of, I bought the book and used it basically as part of my coaching philosophy from then onwards.
And also to improve your own playing as well.
Yes, because I was still young enough then. I was probably, you know, what was it, 19, 20, 21, 22, so I was still playing at sort of, you know, the third tier of football in Holland, but at the same time was trying to combine it with, you know, coaching and doing the, the coaching courses.
And it was Coerver that got you out to the Middle East?
Yeah, eventually. I managed to, I've done my different coaching badges, and then in Holland I was going into the coaching level one. It was difficult to get on it, but I got on it through what it's called in Holland, the CIOS. Let's say it's a central institute of sports education. So you can have different directions. Obviously, I chose football, and that was great. And my final assignment, I based around the Coerver method. So I produced a video of about 20 minutes, which with a professional camera crew, it cost me at that time about £3,500, which I borrowed from my brother, and I still thank him for that. And I managed to get it to the journalist that actually wrote the preface of Will's book, so he knew him and etc. And that's how I got in touch with him. And then in 93, that's where I finally, you know, got an offer from Will Kerr, because he was moving from Dubai to Qatar to do a different project, and if I could, you know, join him and help him.
And you went out there and you started coaching?
In 93, yeah, that's when I basically finished my football. I was 29 at the time, and I flew out there, and then we were responsible for sort of the whole technical development of all the, let's say, to build everything from 12 years and younger, because there was nothing existing at that time. So that was a really interesting period, working with him, alongside him for nearly 4 years.
Right, so how does one go from being a coach, basically grassroots academies in the Middle East, to getting the job to be doing the Manchester United youth coach? How does that happen?
Yeah, I think it's a good question, because a lot of people think, exactly how does that happen? But whilst I did my coaching badges in Holland, I also knew it's going to be very difficult for me to eventually do the pro license, because I haven't had, you know, an extensive, you know, professional career as such. And there's always, you know, various, but also political reasons why people are given it or not. And not necessarily a top professional player doesn't necessarily make a good coach. So there's different qualities to be needed. But I thought to myself, there's different, you know, coaching courses all over the world. So I went to England in 95. Whilst I was in Qatar, I did 95, I did the international prelim course. No, that was 93, sorry. 95, I went for the full batch. 97, I went for the advanced fullbacks, and eventually I managed to do the pro license in England as well. So I was always in England, and in that those courses, I met Dave Richardson, who was then working for the, you know, the Premier League sort of, and helping Howard Wilkinson to make sure that all the academies were set up in the right way.
Yeah, so this is the genesis of the academy, going from school to excellence.
Absolutely.
To academies.
Absolutely. And Dave, at one point, I took the Qatari national under 16 team here as part of a guest of the Nordic Cup tournament with England and Norway and Iceland and Denmark and all. It was a big experience for those young players. And we stayed at Kiel University, and Dave was running a coaching course at that time. So it was a great opportunity for me to basically show what we've done with those kids from the age of 8 who are now 15, 16. So they were all kids, you know, from Qatar, very tiny, small country, but very, very skillful. And Dave said, well, this is something what we need here in England. Would you like to come and work in England? I said, yeah, of course, no problem. So Dave has tried with different clubs to get me in, and nothing really worked until Les Kershaw, for the then academy manager for Man United, contacted Dave and said, listen, Dave, we are got these academies now, we all got all these young kids, etc., but we are looking for a coach that can really develop the technical side. Again, we can't find anybody, at least not in England. So Dave says, well, I understand your problem. He says, I do have somebody, but he's not English. You know, he's from Holland, but he works in Qatar in the Middle East. He's had his coaching education through Wiel Kerver, da 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 da, and that's how we set up a meeting at one point with Les.
And you become United's, because your official title is youth coach. But what was your
no? It was good actually, because we had to invent a title at that, and Les was brilliant at it. He said, we skills development coach. I wasn't having one particular team. I was basically spread out of, you know,
was
the
that coach education then rather than
No. It was both. It was everything. It was working with the youngest kids that we had that we brought in, because at that time at United the rules were still that you can only pick players from an hour and a half. Now that's disappeared, but that's why we had several development centres in that 1.5 hour thing. What I did was to sort of streamline all those development centres that they were doing the same things, you know, not in centre A they're doing that in training and in centre B they do this. So to streamline that, so I had to educate all those development centre coaches. We then established 4 advanced centres, sort of to mean that we could better streamline the better kids coming forward. So I had a better idea which ones we wanted to sign, which again is a little bit, I don't know whether that's still the case, but you know, the bigger the base, the better, because it's very hard to determine which kids at an age of 8 is going to make it eventually. There's so many variables going into it. But at the same time, I did a parents' education. Obviously, I did in-house coach education. So everything needed to sort of follow through. And all those young players like Lingard and Rashford were part of that. You know, yeah, Pogba came a bit later.
Yeah,
he came a bit later. But but all those players had that, you know, technical thing. So that was my expertise, basically, to sort of implement that within the club, educate the parents, educate the coaches, develop the players.
Which you can arguably say was pretty successful, I imagine.
It was. We all believed, and more than anything, the most important thing, so Alex believed it was the right thing to do. And I can still remember in the first years that I came, in 2001 and 2002, I obviously invited him over to come and have a look at the cliff a little to road. So listen, at least you've got an idea what we do, but please do come again in half a year's time so you can see the progress, so you know what we try to do.
So is that the first sort of seed in Fergie's mind that he wants you to be doing this for the first team at some point?
Well, it was. It basically, because we had a really, I think, an in-depth chat after the first season in the end of May, come to the end of the season. For maybe 3 hours, we sat down and talked football, and I tried to explain what I saw and how I think it should develop and this and that and the other. And eventually we tapped on the first team. And I said, it's my conviction, and it's also at that time Wiel Kerver's conviction, that done in the right way, still a lot of first team players can benefit from it. The only difference is that you need to work by far more specifically, quicker to their position and what is needed. But it's all about adding something to their game, another bow to their string. And he understood that, so he gave me that freedom then to sort of, and I said, I can show you, no problem. So I started to work with players like Diego Forlán first and foremost, because Diego was that, I've always liked Diego because he's a typical example of a really, really talented, you know, great player that was sort of almost at the wrong club at the wrong time because Root was there, you know, in his position, and Root was banging goals in for fun. You know what I mean? And it was fine. It was difficult for...
You can't compare
it. No, you can't. And it was difficult for Diego to find a way. But Diego really benefited massively from it because he had basically everything.
Well, when he left, he won European Golden Boot.
It was fantastic, honestly. And he's always... We always stayed in touch, even when he left and all this and that and the other. But that's by the by. And then, obviously, Ferguson started to see that more and more. And basically, on the side, I started to work more individually with players. And like I said, with players at that level, with that top level, they do know and feel when they do something which makes them better. Otherwise, they dismiss it. You know, and then Van Nistelrooy came and, you know, I did lits and bops with Giggsy because his career was changing, you know what I mean? He wasn't, you know, the explosive 17-year-old winger, you know, so then you need to turn that experience. But it gave, you know, Ferguson a very good insight in terms of, hey, you know, because... Like I said, players accept it and use it, or they don't, they dismiss it. And that was never the case. So when eventually things moved, you know, progressed within the club for me, you know, taking the reserve team, you know, when Ricky left, was for me another great opportunity to basically mould everything together, because skill training practices have no use if it's not being transferred into the bigger picture, into 11v11. And that, again, comes down to coaching. You know, you need to make sure that the players... So at that time, with the reserves, I had some great set of players again, but you had PK and Johnny Evans.
PK, Rossi, sort of...
Rossi and Fraser Campbell and all that. And all of them was all that. And it was all based on quick combination play, you know what I mean, and that level of, you know, of skill, beating players. It was great, you know, it was great. And obviously, a lot of first-team players that sometimes drop down to work with this or play with the first or with the reserve team, they loved it.
There's always, I'm going to say always actually, because anyone who achieves greatness or pulls something like the Class of 92 books, like right in my line, just behind you, and Cantona's right here. Cantona's sort of given credit for dragging these lads out onto the training pitch after first team training and having Beckham fire balls into him, having a keeper in there, having someone return passes for him or someone play balls into him, because he was working on his game even though he was at the top of his game. And that work ethic transferred into those lads.
Yeah.
Every single time you hear about someone achieving greatness, and we're going to talk about Ronaldo probably more in depth in a minute, for now, keeping it on like this reserve side sort of stuff. Do you think there's something in the players? Does it have to come from within for players to want to do that extra stuff? And it seems to me every time you hear of people doing extra training, it leads to greatness. It doesn't ever lead to mediocrity.
No. And that's so true. I mean, the highest performers and the highest achievers, whether in sport or outside sport, doesn't matter, always comes from within to some extent, because there is a determination comes from a love for the game, a love for something, or the passion for something. And that's why they don't see it as a burden. The extra work is just a normal thing that they need to do to get better and to achieve greatness, because that's what everything ultimately wants to do it for. And yes, you know, and it's not a surprise why, and as I always said, I was in the lucky circumstance to work, you know, for quite some years with those highly talented, motivated players. And as long as those players see that you offer them something that will add to their game and it makes them better, they will grab it and they will use it.
Enthusiasm's always there for them to pick it up.
Yeah.
Let's talk specifically about Ronaldo then, because there's a story that I've read before where 2007 season, Ronaldo had a good season, especially on the back of what had happened at the World Cup.
Yeah.
And then he catapulted himself into another level in the 2008, the Champions League season. So you had a conversation with him before the start of the season, and it said you've scored 23 goals.
Yeah, it came all about because obviously Ronaldo in that season was obviously suspended for the first three games or four games, I think, I can't remember. So at that time, you know, the league games were like week to week, so it meant that if the team was preparing for the games, this and that and the other. So there was a lot of quality training time left for Cristiano and other players, obviously. But it gave me an opportunity to do a lot of individual work.
Doing game-specific tactical stuff for the opposition.
Whatever, but also when they were on the road and they travelled, you know what I mean, and they go a day before, and then you had the game day and then the game day after, you know, there were sort of three good training days. And if you spread it out over a period of 3 or 4 weeks, you look at some, you know,
some serious improvement.
Yeah, well, 12 plus good sessions, you know. And sometimes I had other players that worked with us, whatever, but it was all centered around him. And basically, in one of the first training sessions that we had, I put the question to him, basically says, right, Christian, have you set your targets for this season? And then he basically said, well, why, what do you mean? And I said, okay, let me rephrase this. He says, what are you going to do after training? He says, well, obviously finished, we're going to have a shower and go home. Okay, you're going home, you know where you're going. How are you going home? Yeah, with my car. Great. So you know you're going home with your car. Do you also know what direction, you know, you're going to take, what roads you're going to take? So yes, I'm going to go that. I said, great. Now, I'll keep it really simple, but let's assume if you don't know where you're going, you can get in your car, you drive off, or wherever you go, it is good or bad, I don't know. And that is part of what you need, a sort of direction and purpose to it. So in other words, if I ask you, what is your target for the next season? And you say, I don't know. Then you score 23 last season. Is 23 good? Is 20 good? Is 25 good? But if you want to develop and progress, the target needs to be higher than what you had last year.
You saw him 40.
Well, he said, and that was funny, he says, so what do you think? He says, well, 30. He says, okay, fair enough. And then he said, what do you think? He says, I think 40. So he says, that's nearly...
Where did you pull 40
from? Because he said, that's nearly double.
Yeah.
He's right. And I said, I tell you for reasons for why. Because I've analysed you, I've looked at your game, I've looked at the goals you scored, I also looked at the chances you've missed, and basically, you've not really, really practised that part of your game, you know, sustainably. And that's what we're going to work on, you know. And part of that was, in that process of working on the pitch, there was also things off the pitch, was that I showed him a video of all goals scored by, of not all goals, but goals scored by York, Cole, Solskjaer, Van Nistelrooy, you know what I mean? And it says, you know, these are some top goal scorers that United have. Have a look at them. It was about like a 10-12 minute video. So boom, 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 goals.
Just
goals. It says to him, it says, we looked at it. So he stood there watching. It says, what did you see? It says, yeah, goals. No. It says, what did you see? What do you mean? All right, we look again. Look and tell me what you see. So we watched it again. And then he says, right, yeah, I see that most of the goals are scored one and two touch.
Do you think he was overcomplicating it? Because he definitely was.
No, what Ronaldo always wanted. He wanted to score the perfect goal, you know. One of those, you know, top corner blasters, you know.
I remember the irony of the criticism from that season, from the previous seasons, was it was a show pony, one-trick pony, and he had the big one was no end product.
Yeah.
And then that season he just come out with end product.
So that was sort of the off the pitch sort of things we tapped on. Listen, you need to set targets, because people with targets and aims in their lives are far more successful. Look at what other people did, you know, look and try to analyse, because, you know, that is always a very good coaching tool to look at the best out there. How did they finish? What did they do? So there was that one touch to finish, and there was a variety of finishes. You know, there was tap-ins, there was shots outside the box, volleys, headers, everything. And I said, and then the next thing is that these players are very, very aware where they are in and around the box. So when that goes, and this was one of the best things, and what I've always felt, read, and I put to him, he says, listen, top finishers, all the goals they've scored in the game, they've already scored it about 10 times in the training pitch. So when that ball comes in, whether it's a header, they already know. That's that ball, boom, because it's in their hard drive. You know what I mean? So that means when that happens, and that's where composure comes in. Why are those top strikers so composed? Because they know. It's just they just pull it out from the database. That's a pullback, so that's a little bender in the far corner. Or this, that, and the other, you know what I mean? So in the finishing sessions that we did, I divided the whole area into different segments. You know what I mean? Like a line from the post right to the edge of the box, which was zone one. Which basically says that if you are in that zone, you're on the best scoring opportunity, because the goalkeeper's in the middle of the goal, so you can score in every corner. The moment, and you put in a goal, a line from the goalpost to the edge of the box to the corner, you get sort of a, you know, like a slanted a triangle. So it's different. So now the goal always stays where it is. The goalkeeper moves. So that means that if you are now not facing straight, but you're facing like that, you need to have a different finish. You know what I mean? And you need to work those finishes.
So you was correcting, you was letting the plays happen. And I've read somewhere that you only like to drill something 4 times.
Always, yeah. Repetitions are 4. I've always, you can do series and repetitions. Repetitions always for 4, because that keeps the concentration high and the quality high. So there was sort of a checklist of 6 points which we went down to. And important was also what I call the scoring zones in front of the goal. You know, zone 1 straight in front of the goal. And then you had another 2 lines that go from the post right to the edges of the box, which then creates, you know, zone 1, zone 2, left, zone 2, right, and zone 3s. Zone 3s is possibly the most difficult zone to score from.
Where's that? So if we're looking at, probably not going to be able to see very much here. So we're looking at an 18-yard box here. The goal being here, are we talking on...
Yeah, those angles. So if the goal is here, this is zone 1. You put a line here and a line here. Mm-hmm. So this area and that area is zone 2. Yes, and where a lot of goals are scored from. Yeah. And this is zone 3. So basically, most of the time, it's not impossible. Players have scored. Most likely, you look for a cutback or a cross. But you need to cover all those areas. You know what I mean? And then you start to work on, you know, 1-touch finishes, 2-touch finishes. Where's the service coming from? Is it coming at you? Is it coming from the side? Is it coming from behind? You know what I mean? And that was just a constant, you know, routines that we did in those series in repetitions of 4, you know. And then the last thing is obviously to make sure you hit the right area in the goal. So you know where the goalkeeper is in certain ways, but then you need to look what is the best target area. Is it top corner? Is it low, hard? Is it, you know, whatever?
The opposite cheek is... Opposite cheek is usually where you want to be aiming, just inside the post, with the cheeks of the goal.
Yeah. Well, that's always, as long as it goes in, most of the time. And that is the other thing that I basically spoke to Cristiano about. It's like, I said, imagine you're wearing an invisible rucksack, and every time you score in training, yeah, there's one in the back. And like I said, that's basically filling your hard drive.
Big rucksack now.
He has a big rucksack now. And like I said, because every goal you're going to score from now on, you've already scored it on the training pitch. Always remember that. And that gives you that, you know, that calmness in the box, but also the position, you know.
Where does he rank in terms of the greatest ever? Because I think he's in the conversation for the greatest ever at the moment, not just the current best, but where does he stack up for all time for you?
Well, it is, and I always find it, you know, sometimes a bit of an unfair discussion as such, because, you know, at times in certain periods, you know, you had Di Stefano and Puskas, and then you had Bakamura and Cruyff and Best and Pele and Maradona and, you know, and Ronaldinho have been up there. But if you look in how the game has developed and everything that goes around, the pressure, the amount of games and this and that and the other, you know, look at the games that Ronaldo has played. And you look at the number of goals he scored, the number of important goals he scored. I mean, you know, yes, and there's always this discussion with Messi, and I think, to be fairly honest, Messi and Ronaldo have pushed each other to unbelievable heights. We have to be very fortunate that we had both two of those players playing in this era.
It's going to be like when football goes back to normal when these two finish.
It's going to be...
20 goals a season's good.
It's going to be, I've thought about it really, and you think to yourself, yeah, what does football look like suddenly when those players like Cristiano suddenly are not there anymore? It's a shame, but he is definitely amongst, you know, the all-time greats ever.
Mo Salah's having a cracking season. A lot of people at the moment want to know, is Mo Salah having a season, this season, comparable to Cristiano's Ballon d'Or winning season? His first one, that season.
Well, I think so. Yeah, I think he's definitely, and he should be one of the contenders. It all depends again how this Champions League campaign is going to finish, and that is also a lot of times one of the criteria that they take in account for players to win the Ballon d'Or, of course. So that's interesting to see. But he has got an unbelievable season. You know, everybody's asking, you know, when is this gonna end? When is this gonna stop? And he just keeps on going, and especially with important goals in important games. Mm. That's fantastic. Great player.
Give me an answer. Who's better, Ronaldo 2008 or Salah?
Well, the reason why I think Ronaldo is ahead of him is because he has continuously done it for so many years, maybe more than 10 years, you know. And Salah has a sort of an unbelievable season this year. And I think you need to ask this question again in 10 years' time. And that's the consistency, you know what I mean? And we've seen similar players like Salah having an unbelievable season. You know, I can remember Ronaldinho at Barcelona at one point having two fantastic seasons and then he just faded away. You know what I mean? That consistency that Ronaldo has shown is, you know, an achievement on its own.
Last time we spoke when we did the full-time Villa stuff, you mentioned your interview from when you went from being a youth player. You sort of got lost on Ronaldo stuff, didn't you? When you were youth manager, the reserve manager at United, into being the first team coach when you came back to United. You said Fergie had a flip chart ready for you and he had a couple of things that he wanted you to implement into the first team. Can you remember what those were?
Yeah, vividly. Because I can remember the whole changeover of, you know, McFeeling being promoted to assistant manager, me as first team coach, went very, very smoothly. I thought, again, Ferguson managed that extremely well because it took away all the speculations. It was done around an international break in the beginning of August. We've already taken care of the pre-season. We've already taken care of one of the first games. So basically in that week, and I'm sure he had a chat with Mick as well, but that's what he did with me. So he just asked me to go in his office and he had his flip chart ready, as I said. And he's basically pointed out his bullet points to say, listen, Ren, I just want to make sure that we all see what we want to see in terms of United's playing style, in terms of defending and in terms of attacking. And it wasn't, you know, rocket science. It was just very clear, very concise. Boom, this is sort of when I close my eyes and I want to see United play, this is what I want to see. So when we came to the part of, you know, when we were on the ball and in possession, there was some really, you know, some really interesting stuff about it. You know, possession has always got a purpose. One, you know, obviously when the game starts, you want to keep the ball and start creating chances and score goals, obviously. But if you're winning 1-0 or 2-0 with 2 minutes on the clock before half time, you just keep the ball. You know what I mean? If we are drawing and we need, you know, to get another goal in it, we need more urgency into play. So all those elements were very important to understand.
You train for that then?
Yes.
For a shout on the sideline, or you initiate from the sideline, 2 minutes to go, the clock's
running. Yeah, that was what we call scenario football. We did it quite a bit. You know what I mean? Listen, guys, your team, you know, we've got 4 minutes left, two team, this 2 minutes, you are winning 1-0, you need to hold on, you need to get at least, you know, an equaliser, or you need to score a goal, 2 goals in 2 minutes, otherwise you're out. Those sort of scenarios, which was fun to do.
I started listening to this, actually.
It was, and the play, because it's all about challenging players, otherwise they just play for the sake of playing. But if you put a purpose to it, the game gets a completely different, you know.
And the competitive edge that professional United players have got, I'm sure they don't want to lose, because these lads are going to take a
piece. Yes, and loads of times as well, you know, taking a player off. You know what I mean? You're one less, sort that out. Or you got one more, how are you going to use it? You know, where's the spaces? You know, that sort of stuff. On the time pressure, still keep the quality and the composure. That was the main thing. I think one of the best examples in the game that I can remember that pitifies that was the home game against City, where we won 4-3, when Giggsy slid that ball into Owen. You know what I mean? Nobody would have played that ball.
Scar on my shin from that game.
On that pressure. I'm telling you, Steve, nobody would have played that ball. Everybody would have just, you know, hoofed it back into the thing. Not Giggsy. Slid it, Michael would have, you know, finished. And that sort of stuff, you know, obviously we did at times in training. But to come back to basically, that was one element. And rhythm was one of the most important elements. And he says, we need a team, and that's what top teams do. They have the ability to create rhythm, maintain rhythm, and change rhythm. And it sounds easy, and you think, well, what was he talking about? But that is basically the hardest thing for a lot of teams to do. Top teams can do that. And especially, you see that when you get in tight areas and they can switch to that one-touch football and movement. You know, you can't defend that, yeah? As well as 1v1s, you can't defend. If somebody is that good in the beat to you, goes past you, you're having a trouble. So we're always looking for those elements. And that was the last bit, really. What stuck to me the most was when he said, and when we are attacking, I want to see a team that attacks with pace, You know, pace, power, penetration, and unpredictability. And those four things, with the other thing, I want you to instill that in that team every single day. No matter what you do, whether you do a possession, a conditioning game, a finishing session, it's all those elements I want to see back. And within those parameters, he was very big on making sure that the players understood the options that we were looking for to break them down to create chances. But at the same time, he gave them a lot of freedom to express themselves. And that gives, you know, the, how do you say, the excitement, basically, because players have to come up with their own solutions.
Two questions I want to ask right at the same time. And if I ask one of them now, I'm going to lose the other one. So that one's written down, and I'll get to that one in a second. That's the 99 versus the 2008. But I want to know where tactics come from. I want to know where you look at, you know, from Sir Alex. We're playing Arsenal next week. We was watching the Arsenal goal earlier, some of the Arsenal goals that we had the 2009, the 2010 season. Those counter-attacking goals. Where does the tactic come from? Where is there a coaches meeting? Is there analysts? Is there opposition scouts?
Yeah. Yeah,
how does the tactic come from?
Yeah, a combination of all, basically, Steve, because obviously you got scouts, you know, that bring in the reports and everything. At that time, we were working, or I was working very closely with Simon Wells, the video analyst, who is, I believe, still in the scouting setup now. But Simon was extremely good at the job because he was not very good only at being an analyst and putting video clips together. He understood the game, and he understood what United stood for. So he knew.
The analyst has to know what your tactics are so he can tell you that you're not adhering to them while you are.
Yes. So I spend a lot of times from, I got the reports, Alex got the reports, Mick got the reports, you know, we all got the reports, we all read the reports, and then it's all about, is this backed up with what we see? So what sort of picture are we looking at? And then for me,
look at the opposition first.
Well, yes, because obviously we know. Well, we like I said, our style and identity is there. But, and that's what we try to achieve. And the aim is, obviously, to win games. To do that, you need to create chances, score goals, and don't concede. Yeah, don't forget that, because that was equally as important for Ferguson and anybody else. Don't, because we always used to say, listen, goals will win us games, clean sheets will win us trophies. So it was very clear, and we were very proud of that, as being, you know, a team that didn't concede a lot of goals. But that's the package. We have a style. This is how we want to play. Yeah, and you know that. That's the elements of pace, power, penetration, unpredictability. That was coming in all the time. We want to dominate whenever we can, if possible. So that was it. But then every opposition has got a different storyline, so to speak. So you need to get prepared for that through your coaching, your scouting reports, the analysis, through the videos. And that's all about identifying trends. Yeah, and the trends are, what sort of system are they probably playing? What are their key players? How have they scored their goals? What is the trends? Where can we stop them? Where can we hurt them? That's basically it.
So you receive the report, go and read it independently, and then you lot come and sit around a table and talk about that?
Well, yes.
With a plan from there.
Yes, eventually we would all come together, and then Simon would have already had, you know, in advance certain things prepared. So listen, you read this, and that, and the other. Or there's anything the manager picked up, or Mick or myself.
How far out?
What do you mean, how far out?
The game's this Saturday.
Yeah.
We're recording this today on Thursday. When would this meeting have took place? Monday or last week even?
Well, obviously, the sequence of the games that we had and the pattern was always like weekend, midweek. So we always tend to...
I can't see a place where...
Yeah, obviously, when the season starts, there's not much to talk about because obviously there's no games being played. But as the season gets on, we would always have at least three scouting reports of the three previous games. And then obviously if, for instance, like Arsenal was in the Champions League, for instance, see if they do anything different. You know, you've got that as well.
Rested anybody.
And obviously all those games and you've got game footage for, you know, how many games have been played. So, and how relevant they are, you know. And you looked at that and like I said, Simon was very good in identifying certain trends or certain combinations, you know, if they play with this, then they play with that. With regards to Arsenal, why have we been in that period so successful against them? Because we basically identified what the trends were and how to basically counterattack them. There was always this link between a deeper lying midfielder and a frontman, i.e., you know, Fabregas from Persie or Arteta with Gazzola or something like that. So, first of all, you know, stop the link. You know, don't let him get on the ball. Yeah, well, whatever. Stop the link. Plus the fact that we knew that the style that Arsenal was always played was all played on short passes and possession. So it was always into feet. So rather than defending, you know, sort of dropping off and defending and defend behind players, we defend sort of side on. And it was all based on intercepting passes. So we knew they were going to play that pass. So we wanted to have one element of rushing players into a pass they didn't want to make. And if they have to, could we intercept? And then there were spaces because Arsenal was always spread out. So the main thing is, if we got in possession, was always, can we hit a penetrating forward pass to get somebody in the distance there, or run with the ball? And then we had players like, obviously, Nani, Rooney, Park, Ronaldo, flying machines, and they went for it.
Really
wonderful. And it was all being direct, pace, direct, all the things that I just said.
Do you think that's... there's an element of Jose Mourinho has got that kind of number on Jurgen Klopp at the moment, that he knows what's coming, that he doesn't change his tactics very often. So Jose makes United extremely hard to beat in those circumstances, but you know, we've only managed to beat them the once in the last couple of years.
Yeah. It's funny that because Klopp has got one over Pep Guardiola, isn't he?
Yeah, it's, you know, like a mad little triangle where one yeah. thing, like, because I think apart from the last derby, I think Pep generally got Jose's number. I don't think Jose can figure him quite out.
Yeah, it is a strange phenomenon, basically. But I mean, everybody does, especially now with all the technology available. You know, Pep Guardiola won't do anything different. So will Klopp. So will Mourinho. They've got all that. What do you call it, access to these scouting reports, to the video analysis and this and that and the other, and then they paint their picture. The difference was with us is that a lot of times we were sort of steps ahead, and then when we invited, you know, Sir Alex Ferguson to come to sit with us and say, listen, this is what we found, have you picked anything up, but this is what we think. So we were already, rather than Sir Alex Ferguson telling us, you know what I mean? And then we...
So you come to him with the plan and he rubber stamps it?
Not, well, not necessarily the plan. We would say, listen, we're thinking of maybe, you know, this might be an option, that might be, what do you think? You know, and then, and obviously it'd give him a little bit of time again, because in his head he knew, because you know how he was, especially in early parts of the season, three quarters, he did use his squad really well. So he was moving players about, and we had to begin to anticipate on that.
So you'd have to like anticipate what his rotation essentially.
Yeah, because obviously he you know, so Alex was always very keen in making sure that all the players were involved, used them, you know, to the best. I'm sure that everybody knows that sometimes, you know, we came up with teams that people scratched their hat. Not the least, for instance, the one with against Arsenal where we played Fabio and Rafael as right and left wing.
And it was amazing.
You know what I mean? But that was basically, but that, just to go back to that,
tell
was
me how that meeting went,
because we were
sitting there going,
not at all. We all came to it, and the reason why is, was we were very clear that if we do certain things right with Arsenal, we've got the best chance of beating them, i.e. don't let them play out from the back, you know, stop the link, this, that and the other. So forget, we had Chicharito and Rooney up front that game, and I think on top of my head, I think it was John O'Shea and actually Darren Gibson sitting in midfield, you know, and then, I'm almost certain. And then we had normally a good back four, but that was sort of solid. But what we did basically was we struggled a bit with personnel, because we had obviously Champions Leagues coming up and a lot of games coming up, and he wanted to rest one or two players. And I said, to keep that energy high, and obviously Fabio Rafa, they were used to sort of play as wing backs.
I'm crazy.
Yeah, but they would be able to maintain that at least for 45 minutes. So constantly in the face, constantly chasing things down, constantly, you know,
pushing.
Exactly. And it worked. And that's what I liked about, as well as with Sir Alex, the flexibility that he had to go with things like that.
Yeah, you know? That was mad. Let's talk about this fella. This is obviously from his debut season. Paul Pogba. When he came through at United, how good did you think he was really going to be? Because I think his debut, I was sitting there gobsmacked, like, watching in the academy, knew how good him and Ravel Morrison both were, and thought, this guy's going to stay at Manchester United forever.
Yeah, and we all knew, and we all wanted that, because we were making clear plans of Pogba coming into the first team setup, and obviously then you build them up, and you're going to give him more and more game time, and et cetera, et cetera. So that was all pencilled out. Obviously, it didn't work out eventually, because obviously the club, you know, and ages that got involved couldn't work out, you know, and you know how it goes. And then eventually, you know, the decision was made that he could leave, and he went, obviously, he went to Juventus.
Now that he's returned, where does he stack up in terms of the best midfielders in the world, and how good can he be for United? What's his strengths? You've seen him up close and personal in training day to day.
Yeah, his strength is definitely, you know, box to box. You know, he needs to be a powerhouse in midfield. He is. He needs to get his sloppiness out of the game. You know what I mean? He needs to, because he's a good passer of the ball. He's creative. You know, he's got a good shot outside the box. He needs to be that threat. You know what I mean? But he needs to understand that at times he also needs to be that sort of calming influence, and like Michael Carrick, you know, just keeping the ball. You know what I mean? Rather than just giving those silly passes away. You know what I mean? He needs to get that immaturity out of his game. You know what I mean? He needs to be the one that can create and change rhythm. You know what I mean? Whereas Matic, for instance, is probably not the person that can do it. You know, Matic is a very, you know, takes a lot of touches on the ball, and there's a danger that things that the game gets laboured and slow. And you need players that can say, nope, now give it to me, and I go boom, 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 boom. You know what I mean?
Do you think that three works? Because in my head, last season our best performance was Carrick, Herrera, Pogba as a midfield three.
Yeah.
This season, I assumed Matic comes in to replace Carrick.
Yeah.
He's not the same player, but he can do a job that Carrick does. Herrera, Pogba, midfield three. It should work. It didn't work. For Barnsley. It worked against Spurs last weekend, but...
Yeah, well, I think... See, I think at the end of the day, and that's one big thing, I think, for Mourinho anyway, but all the players are such, but there's always two sides to the game, isn't it? The attacking side and the defensive side. And that is something which is, I think, is not one of Pogba's strengths, you know what I mean? But it has to be done in the right way. So it is finding that right way. So in some ways, you want to give Paul that freedom to, and the ability to express themselves, you know what I mean? And then you can do things, whether you sort of build something around them to protect him a little bit, you know what I mean? Or you need to obviously coach him and educate him that is also a part of a game he needs to improve, wherever you want him to play. But he's got this, you know, look at his size, man. And when he's opening his legs, he, you know what I mean? And he can find a killer pass. You saw that the other day, one of the goals when he put it in for Lukaku, you know what I mean? With the outside of the foot. So he's got all that. There's so much more to come. He's nowhere near yet, in my opinion, by the best midfielders out there. But he can get there, you know. But like I said, he needs to have his support as well.
Right, let's wrap it up on this one because I'm conscious that we've been here hours. 1999 versus the 2018. Because for me, that is the only conversation to have about what's the greatest English team of the modern era. It's two United sides and it's 99 versus 08. In your opinion, which was the best?
2008, because that's when I got involved.
No. I actually agree with you on it, and my reason is, at that time we'd had Arsenal in a Champions League final 2006, Liverpool in 2005, 2007, United and Chelsea in 2008, United in 2009. English football was dominating European football, and United dominated the Premier League in that time, won three back-to-back, three Champions League finals in 4 years, Champions League winners. How can anyone sit there and compare any other English team to that?
Well, I agree, and it was a unique team with unique players, absolutely. And that's, I think, as well, as people sometimes are too quick to jump and say that's the greatest team ever. Now, consistency comes into it. We talked about it in terms of, you know, the personal achievements of Cristiano Ronaldo. Let's say with Salah having a great season. Yes, at this moment we've got new champions, you know, which have a fantastic season. But the consistency that United have done it over many, many years, but especially in that era, in that period, was unique.
Did it come easy?
No.
Three titles back to back, because from the outside that can look quite simple.
Yeah, well, nothing comes easy. But again, it comes down to a combination of factors that one. So Sir Alex Ferguson at that time, he knew the Premier League, you know, inside out. You know, was the inside of his pocket. He could read and he knew. And I always remember he used to say, "Listen, by the end of January, if we are top of the league, or if we're not more than 5 points off, we're in a good position." You know what I mean? That sort of thing. And like I said, he used this quote well. The players were all they felt valued. You know, he used the squat really well. And it was not in that period, you know, if we were going to win anything, what were we going to win? And obviously the priorities was always Premier League, Champions League, you know, and an FA Cup and the Charity Shield as such, or the Carling Cup, whatever you call it, the Carabao Cup now. And basically the only one in that period that I was there that we sort of missed out on was the FA Cup. You know, for whatever reason, we got to finals, we got to semi-finals, but never won it in that time.
How big a miss was Darren Fletcher when we couldn't play him against Barcelona?
He was definitely a miss, but that's with every good players that you've got at that time. But especially those two finals that we played, we did play in at that time in that era, also for Barcelona, who dominated Barcelona such and thing, and they were exceptional. I can still remember speaking to Pep Guardiola a few months after that, when we were in pre-season in America and we played Barcelona and Washington, and I got a few minutes with him in the, you know, outside the dressing room, and he summed it up. He says, "Yes, I know Rene and da da da." He says, "But I've got Messi." Summed it up for me.
You did have Messi.
Yeah, of course. On top of that, he had another good players, but he had Messi, and look at him now. I mean, look at Barcelona now. Messi was fit. I think he's now 80% of what Barcelona is. Every time he doesn't start or doesn't play, they struggle. So that's going to be an interesting one. Life with Barcelona without Messi.
Yeah, God, yeah. It's coming.
It is coming. Yeah, absolutely.
Rene, thank you very much. This was absolutely fantastic.
No problem.
You guys at home have enjoyed that. Let me know in the comments who you want to see come on next. I'm going to steal Rene's phone and I'm going to go through all his numbers and see who he's got. Thanks for watching. I'll see you in a bit.